for today is to make a lot of noise and let people in this country know that we're loud and we need to be heard.
Shortly after the inspectors left Iraq, it had been discovered that the United States had been using the inspectors to spy on the Iraqis for the U.S.'s own intelligence purposes.
Any potential threat from Iraq has been exaggerated beyond reason, and it smacks of paranoia.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Wednesday, November 20th, 2002. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Iraq's vice president said today that there would be limits on the UN weapons investigation, though the top inspector says Baghdad has agreed to unannounced checks even on Saddam Hussein's special sites. Chief Weapons Inspector Hans Blix says the question of unannounced checks on sites like Saddam's palaces, an issue that helped derail inspections in the 1990s, is settled by the resolution. It wasn't even discussed, he said. Blix made his comments after departing Baghdad at the end of a two-day visit inaugurating a new UN oversight program 4 years after the last inspections. But even as the inspection teams are poised to begin their work to determine if disarming Saddam Hussein is necessary, the Bush administration is studying war. U.S. embassies in 50 countries have been told to sound out foreign leaders about their willingness to wage war if Iraq fails to comply. Dr. James Jennings, president of Conscience International, is a humanitarian aid organization that's been working in Iraq since 1991. We spoke with him this morning from Baghdad, where he says Inspector Hans Blix brought the Iraqi people some welcomed news.
Well, his initial statement when he arrived was that even though the resolution itself only indirectly referred to the lifting of sanctions, that it is his hope and goal that when the weapons inspections are completed satisfactorily, that the sanctions will be lifted, which is something the Iraqis have been wanting to hear and did not hear from the Security Council. The second thing was that the region of the Middle East should be free, nuclear-free, and free of prohibited weapons all around, and not just on the part of Iraq, which is also something that should concern the Security Council, but apparently doesn't. And those two statements were welcomed by the Iraqis.
Now, you are a doctor. What is your purpose there?
Well, our organization has been trying to help ameliorate the effect of the downstream effects of the 91 war and the sanctions. And we still haven't been able, nor have all the other humanitarian aid organizations here, been able to clean up the mess from the 91 war. And we still have lots of health impacts, infrastructure degradation, issues of the economy and psychological trauma that people are going through, post-psychological stress syndrome, which is very serious all around. It costs a great deal of money and takes a lot of time to rebuild those conditions, pre-war conditions in Iraq. And so every single humanitarian aid organization has issued a statement deploring the idea that there would be a new war, which would actually destroy what we've worked so hard to try to rebuild and create greater havoc. This morning, I was at the hospital, the Markaz Jarrah Al Alb, the Center for Heart Surgery, and we're trying to save the life of a 10-month-old baby who will die if she doesn't get the heart cardiac surgery, and may die if she does because the conditions here are not conducive to post-operative recovery very easily. So this is a huge problem throughout the country. There are about, the Minister of Health told me there are 4,000 children awaiting urgent heart surgery, and yet they can't really do it adequately on a large scale in this country.
How much of what you're seeing and working to try and ameliorate as a result of the 1991 war are the result of the ongoing sanctions against the Iraqi people?
Well, a great part of it is because, but some of it, of course, is from the things like depleted uranium in the soil in this region around Basra. And
it came from the missile tips. That depleted uranium came from missile tips, U.S. weapons.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so you have such things as the annual incidence of malignancies rising among children in Basra, rising steadily from 1990 to 2000. The proportion of children under age 5 with leukemia increased from 13% to 56%. The percentage rise in the incidence of malignancies among children generally from in the 10-year period from 1990 to 2000 was 384%. So there's something serious about that, and but that's the ongoing effects. But the sanctions have continued to have a grip on the people. However, the Oil for Food program has helped so that there are more cars on the street and fewer beggars than there were, say, 3 years ago. Nevertheless, the employment rates, the economy, the inflation, the impact on the average family hasn't really changed that substantially. Mm-hmm. But cancer has increased an overall rate of 11.5%. In the 7 years after the Gulf War.
Has your
And there are a lot of birth defects situations as well.
Mm. Has your organization, Conscience International, sought an audience with President Bush or any members of his cabinet?
We have tried in every way we can to communicate with the Congress, with the administration, with the U.S. mission to the United Nations, and certainly they're aware of the efforts. Not only that, in the previous administration, I think all the representatives of most of the major religious organizations, let's put it that way, in the U.S. wrote letters to the Clinton administration begging a change in the policy toward Iraq, which was harming civilians and not achieving any political objectives. Both administrations have turned a deaf ear to that.
Mm. Any final thoughts on your part, Dr. Jennings?
Well, I just think that it's important to realize that any potential threat from Iraq has been exaggerated beyond reason, and it smacks of paranoia. If Iraq is a clear and present danger, it's not evident to its neighbors. None of the neighbors around Iraq want a war. They do not consider that there's any immediate threat. And Americans need to learn more about the reality of the Middle East and not depend on just a narrow group of biased opinion makers who all sing the same tune. They've been fanning the flames of war in America for years, and there's quite a war fever in the U.S. When you come here, it's quite different. There isn't the same preoccupation with the war, and there isn't the same fear, it seems. Searched and inspected in every building that I go in here, but very often in the U.S. I am. So it's a different situation. It seems that we ought to follow our own creed in the U.S., which we say we believe in democracy and self-determination, but it seems we're meddling in the affairs of other countries right now.
Dr. James Jennings, president of the humanitarian aid organization Conscience International and longtime professor of Middle East and Islamic studies. Students at colleges across New York put down their books and hit the streets instead today, protesting the impending war with Iraq. Maya, a 21-year-old student at New School University, says over 1,000 high school and college students have taken to the streets chanting "No war in Iraq" and "Not in our names."
I think a lot of people in this city are feeling very discontented that this government has waged wars around the world and now they're going into Iraq. And as people living here in this country, we feel a tremendous sense of responsibility to stand up and say no. And especially as youth and students, we feel that we need to be in the forefront of the movement of resistance in this country.
And we asked Maya if she believes their action will be heard in the Oval Office where the decisions are made.
There's a lot of media here, so hopefully this will get to not only people in this country, but people around the world, that we are standing with them and not with U.S.'s agenda to take over the world. We're doing a lot of different campaigns that are in place right now. The intent for today is to make a lot of noise and really bring the youth and student energy up to the forefront and let people in this country know that we're loud and we need to be heard.
When we look back 4 years later after the withdrawal of the weapons inspectors from Iraq, it's disturbing to see how the major media outlets have engaged in a somewhat revisionist spirit or collective amnesia regarding exactly why the inspectors were withdrawn from that country. Seth Ackerman of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting spoke with us on that topic.
Since 1998, when weapons inspectors left Iraq, there's been sort of a rewriting of history about how the weapons inspections process ended. At the time, you know, the ending of the inspections was reported pretty much accurately, which is that, you know, the United States decided to bomb Iraq because it claimed that Iraq was not cooperating sufficiently with the inspectors. And so the U.S. And the U.N. Basically had the inspectors withdrawn to protect their safety during the bombing campaign, which lasted about a week and was called Operation Desert Fox, took place in December of 1998. So the inspectors were withdrawn voluntarily by the UN, and that was not controversial at the time. Everybody reported it that way. But once the inspectors were gone and Iraq didn't let them back in, the story was sort of turned around and made as if Iraq had kicked out the inspectors. And that's why there were no longer weapons inspectors in Iraq.
And I see here in your article you have actually some examples of what ran in the New York Times.
Well, they were pretty much, you know, the standard kinds of instances like you see in the report. The New York Times would say, weapons inspections have not taken place in Iraq since the inspectors were kicked out 4 years ago or 3 years ago, depending on when the article was written. Or, you know, they'd use the word expelled, or they'd say since Saddam kicked them out. It's not just the New York Times. The Washington Post actually did this so many times that when FAIR put out an action alert, chronicling how they've made this mistake so many times, the Post did, to their credit, actually run an ombudsman column about the subject and sort of apologizing for having gotten it wrong so many times. This is something that's sort of endemic in the media.
How do you suppose it happens? I mean, we know that there are these public relations firms that are paid extremely well to put a spin on various stories, and particularly the story around Saddam Hussein and Iraq and Afghanistan, just about every major story that the administration feels is important enough to have its spin on.
I think it's more of a question that reporters have sort of a standard sort of moral economy set up in their heads about how the Iraq story works. And if there's a problem between Iraq and the United Nations or Iraq and the United States, it must be because Iraq had done something to cause this problem. So the idea that if inspectors are not in Iraq, it must be because Iraq kicked them out, not because the UN withdrew them. And I think that probably if you look at how, you know, if you could sort of trace how this this incident was talked about following, you know, after it happened, you'd probably find that a lot of, Clinton, back then it was the Clinton administration, a lot of Clinton administration officials probably, you know, got up and said, you know, Saddam, they sort of elided the truth and said Saddam kicked out the weapons inspectors. And instead of reporters listening to that and saying, wait a second, that's not how it happened, instead, because they have such a tremendous amount of, they give such credibility to national security officials. Instead of questioning that account and remembering that was not the way it happened, they sort of absorbed that into their own memories. And it took, you know, a lot of reminders from FAIR and from some other groups for them to sort of jog their memory and realize that that's not how it happened.
And so after FAIR points this out to them and sort of pulls their coattail, and they make the apology, is it then reflected accurately in their subsequent reporting?
It happens less often, largely because we managed to get to the most important newspapers to change the way they do it. And, you know, since everybody else reads those papers, they sort of start remembering, oh, yeah, the inspectors weren't kicked out. They were withdrawn.
Is this the only issue or topic that you've noticed this vast discrepancy or rewriting of history, as you say, around the Iraq issue?
If you remember, shortly after the inspectors left Iraq, there was a sort of a major scandal at the UN Security Council because it emerged, you know, it had been discovered that the United States had been using the inspectors to spy on the Iraqis for the U.S.'s own intelligence purposes, which is sort of one of the major reasons that a lot of friction developed between the inspectors in Iraq. And it's interesting because, you know, in the latest round of negotiations at the Security Council for this new resolution that was passed recently, this question of the U.S. spying that was done in the old inspections teams, this is a huge issue, especially for the French and the Russians and the other countries. When they were, you know, setting up this new inspection team, they wanted to make sure that the U.S. wasn't going to do again what it did before. So, for example, you know, there's a rule that says now that that all the inspectors have to be career U.N. civil servants. They can't be employees of the United States government. Well, the U.S. was working as hard as it could to get that you know, provision removed so that it could put its own people in there. And it was a provision that was put in there specifically to prevent the U.S. from spying on Iraq through the inspections. So all throughout this process of negotiations, you know, the mainstream media in this country were running articles reporting about Iraq's objections to the weapons inspectors and so on. And a lot of them would say things like, Saddam Hussein, or Iraq, claims that the weapons inspectors were spying on Iraq back when they were still there.
Claims that.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you go back, you'll find these very same news outlets back at the time were doing investigative stories in which their own reporters were confirming the fact that the spying was going on, not from Iraqis, but from senior United States officials and military officials and from inspectors.
I don't know. I smell a spin doctor somewhere.
It's true, and I think there's the same sort of hesitation that at work among the reporters. They hesitate to say straight out at a moment when there's a big national debate over inspections and the president is getting up and saying we need to get inspectors back into Iraq. They hesitate to even if they know it, they don't want to write it that, you know, the last time these inspectors there, they were doing something that was illegal and against their mandate and contributed a great deal to the inspection system breaking down, and it was the United States that was doing it. You know, that's especially in this atmosphere right now, I think that a lot of reporters are afraid to write that, even if they know it's true.
Seth Ackerman is a correspondent for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, a media watchdog group based in New York. Well, in recent years, the U.S. government has come to rely heavily on private PR firms to rally public support for various military endeavors. One of the most prominent PR companies today is the Rendon Group, who recently hired an Iraqi-American student to record spoofed speeches of Saddam Hussein for propaganda broadcasts throughout Iraq. We spoke earlier today with Ian Urbina, whose article entitled "This War, Brought to You by the Rendon Group," appeared in a recent edition of The Village Voice.
Rendon has a long sort of history. He's actually an interesting character. I mean, he's a longtime sort of card-holding Democrat and actually rode his way into Washington in the 70s as a sort of 20-something, you know, McGovernite, and was an aide, was the main sort of strategist behind the Dukakis' gubernatorial campaign in 74, and you know, has a range of clients, you know, previously ranging from the AFL-CIO and you know, Jimmy Carter, all the way over to more recently a much more sort of military portfolio. So the CIA and Pentagon are sort of his biggest clients within the last 10 years. But I mean, he really kind of cut his teeth when it came to war PR in 90 when he was brought on initially by the Kuwaiti government, and then subsequently he landed a CIA contract. And at that stage, as you remember, it was gearing up to the first war in Iraq, and his job was to really mobilize American public opinion behind that war.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Rendon Group is considered sort of the ultimate spin doctor, and it's had assignments dating back to 1989 in a campaign against Panama's Manuel Noriega. It's done work for Haiti, around the Haiti situation, Kosovo, Zimbabwe, as you said, the Gulf War, and Afghanistan. Which was the more interesting of those assignments, would you say? What can you tell us about those?
Well, I mean, to be frank, I don't know a whole lot about the nuts and bolts and gory details of the other assignments. He also did Colombia, I would add to that list. And there's some question as to whether he's still working on that sort of largely undiscussed U.S. campaign. But I mean, my personal sense is his work in the Middle East and surrounding Iraq, and specifically his work with the INC, is his most consequential and interesting and sordid assignment. And longest running. I mean, Kosovo and Haiti and Zimbabwe were sort of, by comparison, short-term and on the cheap. The biggest sort of boon financially and politically for him has been Iraq.
And so what is the spin cycle now around Iraq?
Well, I mean, there's real question as to whether he's currently working on Iraq or not. There's no question that he is still on the Pentagon's dole. He, right after 9/11, landed a very large contract with the Pentagon, you know, of the tune of $7-8 million contract, to chart sort of public opinion and specifically press throughout the region, throughout the Middle East, and also. Right after 9/11 and as we went into Afghanistan, Rendon was brought on to sort of be the de facto spokesperson, kind of to respond to any and all enemy propaganda or enemy sort of press that was put out in the public. And so that was his most recently known and large contract. With Iraq, like I say, no one really knows as of yet if he's still working on Iraq, and if so, to what financial tune and with what effect.
You know, Rendon isn't the only well-financed professional spin firm out there, you know, doing the Pentagon's PR work. There's, of course, that notorious Hill & Knowlton, the firm which concocted the infamous babies being thrown out of incubators story around the Gulf War. Can you retell the incubator story for our listeners who may not recall precisely what happened there?
Yeah, I mean, the protagonist in that story was, as you say, a public relations firm called Hill & Knowlton. And Hill & Knowlton, H&K, was brought sort of on board in 1990, to again mobilize public opinion behind the war, and I think they would say to raise public awareness of the atrocities committed by the Iraqi government, and on October 10th. There was an sort of session set up in Congress by a sort of Orwellian-titled organization called the Human Rights Caucus, which was headed up by California Democratic Tom Lantos and Illinois Republican John Porter. And at that hearing, there was a sort of presentation put on that had been very carefully choreographed by Hill & Knowlton. The denouement of the presentation was the discussion, the stepping to the podium of a 15-year-old Kuwaiti girl named Nayira, whose last name was withheld upon request, allegedly so as to protect the safety of her family. And Nayira sort of tearfully put forward this tale about what she had allegedly seen firsthand in a hospital in Kuwait City at Al Adan Hospital. And what she had apparently seen was the overturning of, I think it was several, I don't remember the exact number, 50, 60 incubators, and ultimately, allegedly, 315 infants were sort of tipped onto the floor. And this was when, according to Nayira, the Iraqi troops had stormed into Kuwait City and rushed into the hospitals and were stealing the incubators and tossing these babies on the floor. You know, this story that she gave spread like wildfire and was picked up by virtually every major news outlet on the globe within 64 hours. And, you know, upon closer investigation, we came to find out that Nayira happened to not just be sort of an average Kuwaiti 15-year-old, but she was the daughter of Kuwait's ambassador to the U.S., which had not been announced at this hearing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Hill and Knowlton had very closely prepped her before the presentation, as they had set, you know, five of the seven other individuals that stepped up to the podium that day to give testimony. And, you know, there was subsequent investigation, and it was never really, there were never any ties verified between Nayira and this hospital. It was never.
So she made it all up?
It seems that way, yeah. I mean, you know, Amnesty International originally came out with this, statement of outrage about the incubators being overturned, and then subsequently, upon investigation, had to retract their statement. And, you know, it was a very embarrassing escapade. But, yeah, ultimately, you know, it looks like the bulk of the information she put out there was false and was fabricated. And, and not without consequence. I mean, you know, the vote that occurred for the war resolution was a very close one, and you know, the baby incubator story was repeated on the UN floor. It was repeated in Congress repeatedly. So it really affected, as you know, later in an interview with The Guardian, Brent Scowcroft later admitted, you know, it was information that was fairly useful in mobilizing public opinion.
Mm. And so this is the kind of impact that these firms like Rendon and Hill and Knowlton can have. Spinning
yeah.
tales, basically. Telling
sure.
tales.
That's right. I mean, the tail wagging the dog.
Ian Urbina is an analyst with the Middle East Research and Information Project. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. When we come back, actor Harry Belafonte speaks to Peace Watch about the policies of President Bush, human rights, and Colin Powell, and a visit with street poet extraordinaire Brother Blue. Back in a minute.